Welcome to the Denver Community Church Teaching Podcast. We're so glad that you're joining us today from wherever you are. Whether you attend one of our Denver locations or listen online, our hope is to explore and participate in the life of Jesus so that we can be a healing presence in our world. As you listen to this teaching, allow it to begin a conversation between you and God, you and the Bible, and you and your community. If you have any questions about DCC or this teaching, you can email us at info@denverchurch.org. And if you'd like to financially support our community and beyond as we set aside 20% of every dollar given to support our partners locally and around the globe, you can text the words Denver Church to 77977. That's Denver Church to 77977. Thank you for joining us today.
Hello, everyone. It's good to be together online. If you've been with us over the last several weeks, you know that we began 2021 talking about hope. Scott Opliger, our Wash Park neighborhood pastor, did a great job of starting us off the first Sunday of January, and we will continue reflecting on this today. And actually, we'll do this every week through mid-February, which is the beginning of Lent. But for today, we're going to talk about hope. And as we just concluded the year that we don't speak of, and we've had a bumpy start, to put it mildly, to this year, I cannot think of a timelier thing to spend our time discussing. And today, we're going to talk about both hope and reality. Because hope is a call to be real, to be realistic, to be honest about what is going on in us and in our world. Hope is not escapism. It actually has the power to root us firmly here and now. And from that place, lead us into a future that offers endless possibilities. So to explore that today, we're going to look at two separate passages, both in the prophets. The first passage, if you would like to follow along, is found in Jeremiah chapter 28. Now, before we read from there, just a little bit of context is probably helpful. In chapter 28, the city of Jerusalem is in big trouble. They've been beaten up routinely by the Babylonians for a number of years. And most recently, their king, named Jehoiachin, was exiled to Babylon by King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon. And then Nebuchadnezzar set up a new king named Zedekiah. And then not long later, Zedekiah chose to rebel against Babylon and not pay taxes. And of course, this never goes well. And his actions were the last straw for the Babylonians. And so they laid siege to the city. And we know from history, things were bleak. People were dying inside the walls due to starvation. Every day, it only served to move them closer to their certain death, and it was a death that was sure to be gruesome because it was to come at the hands of the Babylonians. The people were terrified and weary. And this is when God spoke to Jeremiah, and he told him to put on a yoke as a symbol of what would become of the people of Jerusalem. They would become subject to Nebuchadnezzar and Babylon in the days to come. Jeremiah's prophecy was a statement of reality. But Jeremiah was not the only one who had an opinion about what was going to happen. Because there was another prophet, and this is where we find ourselves and pick it up in Jeremiah chapter 28, and I will begin reading in verse 1. It says this: "In the fifth month of that same year, the fourth year, early in the reign of Zedekiah, king of Judah, the prophet Hananiah, son of Azur, who was from Gibeon, said to me, Jeremiah, in the house of the Lord, in the presence of the priests and all the people, 'This is what the Lord Almighty, the God of Israel, says: I will break the yoke of the king of Babylon. Within 2 years, I will bring back to this place all the articles of the Lord's house that Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, removed from here and took to Babylon. I will also bring back to this place Jehoiachin, son of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, and all the other exiles from Judah who went into Babylon, declares the Lord, for I will break the yoke of the king of Babylon.'" Now, you read those words, and initially it doesn't seem like there's anything wrong with what he's saying. I mean, right? I mean, here we are, we're talking about hope. So maybe these words of Hananiah were just that. They were meant to inspire hope in the midst of an impossible situation. You know, maybe he's just like I don't know, like one of those upbeat guys who's always happy, nothing ever seems to get him down. You know, the kind, like no matter what happens, they always seem to find the silver lining. They always manage to talk about the bright side of life. Things are always great and super wonderful. And I mean, like, to the point where it's like painfully awkward in kind of in a funny way when someone's like this, maybe like in a movie or a TV show. But in real life, like, we just think they're naive or oblivious or clueless. And with Hananiah, at first glance, it's tempting to see him just this way. But if you keep reading in Jeremiah 28, you realize that what he said, the words that we just read, it's far more serious. Because it turns out his words have dire consequences. At the end of this chapter, Jeremiah says to Hananiah, "The Lord has not sent you. You have persuaded this nation to trust in lies. The Lord says, I'm about to remove you from the face of this earth. This very year, you will die." And sure enough, within a couple of months of Hananiah saying that, he dies. Which raises the profound question, what? Like a guy tries to inspire a little bit of hope and he's struck down by God? Seems a little harsh, doesn't it? And of course, the answer to that question is yes. It is incredibly harsh, especially if he was just trying to inspire a little bit of hope. But like many things, there's far more going on under the surface. What is actually happening is not an attempt to inspire, but an invitation to denial. Now, here's why I say that. The prophets, like Jeremiah, they're fringe characters. They did not hold office in the king's court, nor were they sanctioned by the religious establishments. They were often found on the edges of their communities, speaking into the troubles of their day. And if you spend time reading the prophets in the Hebrew scriptures, one thing that jumps out is that they issued unyielding calls for justice. The prophets spoke out against those in places of power and wealth and influence who ignored the call of God to care for the least of these, as Jesus called them. The prophets spoke the truth. And in doing so, they issued warnings, saying things like, God will not stand by and allow your wrongdoings to go without consequences. And the consequences that many of the prophets spoke of, for the people of Israel, the consequences was exile. For the prophets, exile was the direct punishment for sin. So when a prophet like Hananiah shows up and he says things like, hey, listen, everything is fine, nothing to see here, don't worry about exile, this is just a speed bump in an otherwise perfect world, carry on, business as usual. He's denying the imminence of destruction and exile, and in doing so, he's ignoring the sin and dismissing the injustice. He's glossing over the damage done to the poor and the orphans and the widows and the immigrants. One could even say that in doing so, he's lending tacit approval to the way things have been in Israel. And this is not the only occurrence of this happening in the prophets. In the book of the prophet Ezekiel, he is told to prophesy against those who proclaim peace when there is no peace. Those who speak of shalom, wholeness, peace speaks of the world existing in a way that is reflective of God's heart. You see, the people Ezekiel's going to speak against are saying, there is wholeness. God's heart is reflected in our world. And they say this in the midst of injustice. No. This is why they're accused of uttering false prophecies and lies and leading people astray. They are not truth tellers. They do not deal in reality. Instead, they cover up what's really going on, which allows the members of the community to not face reality. They can live in a make-believe world where everything is just fine. It may appear as though they're just trying to inspire hope. But hope without reality is nothing more than denial. What they are doing allows people to look ahead and not have to face what is real. It allows them to drown out the cries of the oppressed with their music and songs and ignore the weightier matters of the law. It's this kind of willful ignorance and this denial that leads the prophet Amos to say, "Away with the noise of your songs. I will not listen to the music of your harps." Maybe now we can see why the words of Hananiah were a big deal, why they were lies. They were then and they are now. And I say now because hope without reality, the message of denial, is still proclaimed by the people of God. I mean, by the end of this month, it's predicted that more citizens in the United States will die from COVID and COVID-related deaths than all the U.S. soldiers that were killed in World War II. And this number has happened only in the span of 10 months. Our involvement in World War II lasted 4 years. Now, any loss of life is tragic, but at this scale, it's bewildering and tragic in a way that we cannot explain. And in the midst of this, there are many experts and leaders, and they're trying to do as best they can to limit and hopefully even prevent further loss of life. And in doing so, they're doing it in the midst of like uncertainty and learning and the unknown. And of course, you know, there's people who've opposed them and resisted them, staging protests and decrying their loss of freedom and rights and denying what's happening. And who is central to much of this denial and many of the protests? Christians. And not just Christians, but pastors and Christian influencers and Christian leaders. Some have gone so far to say, and I quote one pastor, "There is no pandemic." Really? One well-meaning pastor sent me a four-part sermon series over email. And he said to me, "You can preach these if you want, and you don't have to give me credit." So out of curiosity, I opened the sermon outlines, and the sermon was four reasons why we just need to trust God and not anyone else in the midst of this pandemic. And it went on to dismiss those who've chosen to be careful or churches who've chosen not to gather in person for worship. Like, these are the people who are proclaiming peace in the midst of a pandemic that has taken the lives of hundreds of thousands of people here in the U.S. and nearly 2 million human lives globally. This is hope outside of reality. It's lies. I mean, sure, it tickles the ears of those who listen. It allows their congregations to live in a world of make-believe and ignore what's happening in our world, but it's not true. And what happens if truth is proclaimed? Well, in my experience, people react with anger and they resist the truth when it doesn't fit their narrative. So, you know, as pastors, we dare not tell the truth because you know what happens when the truth is proclaimed. You get in trouble. Like a pastor friend of mine in Oregon, this summer, he preached about the insidious reality of systemic racism in our country, and that same week, he was fired by his board for doing so. Why? Because people react with anger, and they resist the truth when it doesn't fit their narrative. This is why, by the way, prophets are almost always killed. And not just those found in the Hebrew scriptures, and almost all of them were in fact killed. I'm talking about modern prophets like Oscar Romero, Mahatma Gandhi, Medgar Evers, Dr. King. They were truth tellers and they paid the price. Because when a group of people have given their allegiance over to the values and the ideology of the empire, they don't have time for people who suggest that they might be misguided. And when you do speak up and you speak out, you will pay for it. Sometimes with your life. And so in the place of truth, we prefer to hear messages of hope. But here's what we learn from Hananiah. Hope spoken without reality is denial, and it allows us to live in ignorance. And boy, we sure love the bliss that ignorance offers to us, don't we? Like, we'd rather pretend that everything's good. Whether in our individual lives or in our society, denial has become a pathology of our time. Like many in the church have chosen to live divorced from reality, to deny it, to ignore it, and to proclaim a very cheap version of hope. This kind of proclamation, according to the prophets found in the Hebrew scriptures, is a lie. Maybe this is why most churches don't take time to preach from the prophets. I never heard one sermon growing up in all of my years that was ever preached from the prophetic books in the Bible. You know, it could be too upsetting. And we don't want that. I mean, we need those butts in the seats and the dollars in the plates and the elaborate buildings. And for what? So we can be comfortable? Well, I mean, if that is the goal, then consider the church in America largely successful. But we're not even aware of how successful we are because we're so comfortable we've fallen asleep in the comfort of our own freedom and our privilege. To quote the prophet Ezekiel, many of our churches are guilty of the sin of Sodom, which he says that they were arrogant and overstuffed and unconcerned, and they did not help the poor and the needy. I mean, how could we? We want to show up and we want to feel good about the way that we're living and what we believe. And quite frankly, it's this denial and willful ignorance that has led many to walk away from the church. It is a recognition that many people offer very easy answers on many things and deny the complexity woven into some of the most important conversations in our day. And in the midst of heartache and tragedy, they don't cry out. Rather, they offer trite phrases and tired cliches telling us things will get better. Doubt and struggle and pain, those are avoided or those things are explained away. But at some point, the answers and the phrases and the explanations stop working and people leave. And I know this because I've sat with countless people who've given voice to this very thing. They just can't stand the denial anymore. They've called BS, and rightfully so. And if you are listening and you find yourself agitated or maybe in agreement or upset, well, now you know how Jeremiah felt about Hananiah. His words are a big deal. And like the prophets we find in the sacred text, we need to be truth tellers. We need to deal in reality, no matter how painful it might be. But that's not all. Because hope still has a place. And I'm quick to point this out because it seems we're unaware of how often we react rather than respond. Like we ride the pendulum swing to the other side without thinking and often overlook what a healthy response can be. Now, this is not to dismiss the pain and frustration many have felt and still feel. I have had countless conversations with many who've been misled by Christian leaders or have been wounded by the church or have been disillusioned with Christians. Now, they may still be a part of the church, but they often tell me that they are not like those kind of Christians. And they speak of how hateful and bigoted and condemning and unforgiving so many Christians are. And as they share, what is clear is how much they are like the very people, those kind of Christians they hate the most. The only thing that's changed is their beliefs are now a bit different. Now, I empathize with their feelings. And I understand that they're tired of the lies and denial, but in the reaction to those who deny reality, they've decided the best course correction is to be like those who are going to tell it like it is. Of course, this is needed. And honestly, it's really refreshing to witness how many churches are becoming more and more honest because we need to be real and raw and vulnerable about ourselves and our pain and our struggle and our doubts. Like we need voices reminding us there are no easy answers, that life is difficult, that tears are necessary and must be incorporated into life. We need voices constantly making us aware of injustice in all of its manifestations. Those who point toward the broken places in our systems and institutions. Those who are committed to revealing the great inequities that continue to plague our country and world. We must not and cannot be silent about these things. We need to hear the truth. We need to be rooted in reality. We must be committed to telling the truth at all costs. So these voices, they're needed. But what I observed is that what often accompanies this sort of truth-telling is this underlying cynicism. Now, maybe I'm just saying this because, like, I'm an undying optimist, but it's almost as if many have come to believe that being brutally honest is what we need and that it is all we need. I once heard a pastor who was speaking and preaching about how bad things are in our country, and he said to a group of people, "We need to develop a theology of hopelessness." Really? Is that really what we need? And the more I listen to voices that just want to tell it like it is, the more I sense this, like, despair underneath it all. Or maybe it's anger rising from unhealed wounds, or maybe it's just nihilism born of fatigue. Now, what is being said is true. But while these voices are dealing in reality, what is often absent is hope. And the prophets, by the way, they have something to say about this too. And this is what we see in the second passage we will look at today from the book of the prophet of Isaiah. Now, in this context, the people of Judah, which is the southern kingdom of Israel, they are already in exile. They have been confronted with reality. There is no more denying it. And while they are quick to speak of reality, they no longer speak of hope. They believe they will never return to the land. This is all there is. They have learned a theology of hopelessness. But in Isaiah chapter 50, the prophet speaks on behalf of God, who responds to those who have, quote, told it like it is, and have turned towards cynicism and despair. And we read these words in the prophet. God speaking to them and says, "When I came to you, why was there no one? When I called to you, why was there no one to answer? Was my arm too short to deliver you? Do I lack the strength to rescue you?" You see, we hear these words, and it's almost as if God is upset. Because when God comes to rescue, to redeem, he finds no takers. Because the people are convinced that God can't or won't rescue them. And in these words, Isaiah offers a critique of those who've dispensed with hope. A critique that we should heed in our context. Because it seems as though hope has fallen on hard times. Like, many have chosen to tell it like it is, to speak truth, but they do so without hope. And in doing so, it only leads to cynicism and anger and despair and nihilism. Let me say it again. We need to proclaim the truth about ourselves and our world. We need to deal in reality, but we must always do so alongside hope. Because just as hope without reality is denial, which is what we see in Jeremiah, if we speak of reality without hope, that leads to despair, which is what we see in Isaiah. We need to speak of reality and we need to speak of hope. We need to hold these two things together even when it feels impossible, even when it is difficult. This is what it means to be a prophetic community, to recognize that hope and reality are great dance partners, that one without the other leads to either denial or despair, but together, together they have the power to lend us vision for the world in which we live, to see that hope deals in reality, but it does not stop there, because hope knows that things are moving forward and that the story is still being told. Hope opens us up to endless possibilities in any and every situation of renewal and redemption and restoration. Keep in mind, this vision, this is central to our identity as a people. Because we're people of the resurrection. Central to our story is the cross on which Jesus was crucified. Now, this symbol in his day was one of torture and humiliation and death. And for us, in our day, it's at the very same time a symbol of hope. You see, the cross doesn't deny reality. It actually dives headlong into it. It is Jesus in all his vulnerability. He's been beaten. He's been marched through the streets as an object to behold. He's been mocked by those in power. And then he's hanging there on the cross by his hands and by his feet. He's completely naked. He's losing blood nonstop because of his wounds. There's no one there with him to help him or to stand with him. I mean, the cross is a picture of suffering that we cannot comprehend. It is a picture that ends with Jesus saying, "It is finished," and he breathes his last, and he's taken down from the cross, and he's buried in a tomb. And then there's the long hours of Saturday. Like, for his followers, it's like the city feels eerily quiet. The cross where Jesus hung, it's empty. And the pain in the chest of those who pin their hopes on Jesus, it's overwhelming. They are bewildered with disappointment, wondering where and how this all went wrong. They live in fear of who in their company might be the next one to be executed. And as the Apostles' Creed tells us, Jesus on that day descended into hell. You see, the cross does not mince words. It tells it like it is. It proclaims to all humanity the dread and the pain and the fears and the shame, the reality of what life can and does serve up. It's right there, like it's in our faces, and it doesn't shy away from what is real. But we've only talked about Friday and Saturday, which means there is still Sunday. There is still resurrection. And Sunday tells us that very early in the morning, the women went to the tomb to put spices on Jesus' body, but they found the tomb empty, and an angel proclaimed to them, "He is not here. He is risen." If the resurrection tells us anything, it proclaims that even in the moments when it seems things will never improve, when all seems lost, when things are broken beyond repair, resurrection says, no, all is not lost. The story is not over. There are endless possibilities. Do not give up hope. This is the story we have given ourselves over to. And it invites us to trust that no matter how bad things may be, even right here and right now in your life today, no matter how dire things may be in our country, when we cannot imagine for the life of us how things could improve, when we cannot see a way forward, resurrection shouts to us in the midst of this dark reality, don't give up hope. He is risen. And the question for us is, do we trust this story? Do we trust it enough to wade in to reality? Do we trust it enough to be fearless truth tellers? And do we trust it enough to be courageous hope tellers? Because if we can and become those who are at the same time truth tellers and hope tellers, then we will step more fully into our vocation as a prophetic community. And by the way, this is not easy, and it will not be easy. Walter Brueggemann speaks toward this in his incredible book titled Truth and Hope. And this is what he says. It is the work of the church in the United States and a society narcotized by denial and despair to tell the truth and hope in a way that makes new evangelical, small e, referring to the good news of Jesus, makes new evangelical decisions possible. Such a responsibility on the part of the church is risky because no one foregoes the safety of denial and no one readily relinquishes despair for the demanding possibility of hope. This is the invitation and it's the challenge for us, quite honestly, as a people. And it demands something from all of us. For some, it means to cease denying and to turn and to face reality head on. For others, it means to cease despairing and to reach down and pick up hope off the ground. And in this, we can once again become those who, like the prophets before us, speak truth, and speak hope. And we have some work to do. Several years ago, I was with a group of pastors, and we were able to get together and listen to N.T. Wright speak. And he insisted that the church has largely ceded our calling and forfeited our prophetic role in our culture. And he said, and it's the media who's now picked this up. Now, I sat with his words for a long time, considering what he said. But as soon as I heard him, I was like, I think he's right. And I still think he's right. I mean, just listen to conservative Christians talk. It sounds like a lot of sound bites from Fox News. And progressive Christians, so many of their talking points sound like sound bites from CNN. Unless they're like really angry, then they're probably quoting from HuffPost. Now, we have relegated our authority to cable news outlets to the extent that most of us, we don't sound much different from anyone else. We just like mix in Jesus and Christianity here and there or not. I recently read an article written by a guy named Ben Sixsmith who addressed those who identify as Christians. Now, he speaks of both conservative Christians and he speaks about progressive Christians. And he writes as one who's not a Christian and not religious. But he addresses how many prominent Christian writers and influences and speakers no longer really sound distinctive, whether progressive or conservative. And he observes that their voices have kind of like blended into the ambient white noise of our time. And at the end of his article, he writes this. While progressives and conservatives are different in beliefs, such people share patterns of thought. The former conservatives believe secular individualists mysteriously share God's wishes for what should be done with money. The latter, speaking of progressives, think that secular progressives mysteriously share God's wishes for what should be done with bodies. So if Christianity is such an inessential add-on, why become Christian? Now, I'm not religious, so it's not my place to dictate to Christians what they should and should not believe. Still, if someone has a faith worth following, I feel that their beliefs should make me feel uncomfortable for not doing so. If they share 90% of my lifestyle and values, then there is nothing especially inspiring about them. Instead of making me want to become more like them, it looks very much as if they want to become more like me. Let me read that again. Instead of making me want to become more like them, Christians who identify both as conservative and progressive look very much as if they want to become more like me. And then he dropped the mic. Like, have we forgotten that we are a resurrection people? Have we forgotten that we are a prophetic people? Have we neglected our call to offer our world another way of seeing reality and remind people to see our world in light of God's hope and freedom and justice? Like, what would happen if we reclaimed our role, our calling as a prophetic people? What would it look like to be those who speak up and speak out regarding reality? What would it look like to be those who are known as people who never shied away from difficult conversations or refused to live in denial or refused to ignore the injustices that plague our country? What if we were those who were vulnerable and honest? Those who did not have to pretend to have it all together, but who were willing to share our struggles and failures openly? And what if we didn't stop there? What if we were also willing to speak up and speak out regarding hope? And not just like as a fleeting feeling, but what if we gave ourselves over to that, believing that no matter how impossible the situation, we resolved to trust that God has not given up on the world? Like, what if we chose to work as though that were true? What if we were willing to see that hope is resistance to the way things are? What if we understood that the resurrection changed everything? And that same power that raised Jesus from the dead still holds the power to revolutionize and transform this present moment. What if we remembered that we are a resurrection people, a prophetic people? Because as difficult as this season has been on so many levels, we will get through it. And this raises the question, well, what lies on the other side of this season? What will be birthed through this traumatic labor? And I believe that there are many people and waiting for voices who will offer hope in the midst of this reality. Will we be those voices of hope? Will we be proclaimers of the resurrection? And should we choose to be those voices? Maybe then will we reclaim our calling as a prophetic people and become a small part of overcoming the denial and the despair in our world as hope tellers and as truth tellers, as those who together can say with conviction, we are prisoners of hope. Let's pray together. God, we recognize that the resurrection was a shock to everybody who experienced it. That Friday and Saturday, the overwhelming circumstances, the overwhelming reality was so deeply painful that they never saw it coming. Would you create in us, God, an expectancy, a recognition that the resurrection isn't something that just happened historically several thousand years ago. It's something that's happening in our world, under our noses, everywhere we look, all the time. Would that reality root us in this present moment, not just as truth tellers, but as hope tellers? We ask that you would continue to give us vision that would surprise us, that would shock us, that would remind us that we are called to be prisoners of hope, that we are called to speak the truth and hope together as a prophetic community that this world so deeply and desperately needs. We pray these things together today in the strong name of Jesus. And all my friends online said, amen.